listening to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. What happens when you get too many players on the landscape? With all the development scheduled for Alberta's oil sands, it's a recipe for disaster as far as the boreal ecosystem is concerned. That's where something new called integrated landscape management comes into the forefront. It's part of the plans for True North Energy and Alberta Pacific Forest Industries to reduce their industrial footprint on the north. And Dr. James Smythe of the University of Alberta talks about his new study on equity in healthcare funding. All this in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. If you've ever flown over Alberta's northern forests, you've seen the evidence of human activity. There are cut blocks, cut lines, well sites, and roads as far as the eye can see. Project the billions of dollars worth of oil sand activity, logging, and urban expansion into the future, and you can guess what this will do to the boreal ecosystem. In fact, there might not even be enough trees left to make logging a viable industry. Enter the age of integrated landscape management. This is a science-based program aimed at getting different industries to plan their developments together to reduce their impact on the environment. One example is the cooperation between Alberta Pacific Forest Industries and True North Energy. David Park is the president and CEO of True North.
Our leases are approximately 90 kilometers north of Fort McMurray. We are directly north of Syncrude's Aurora mine. I believe our plant site will be about 5 miles away from their plant site. And they're directly north of Shell or Albion's Muskeg River mine. So we're in a concentrated area with a fair amount of activity. Like those projects, we will have a surface mine with large trucks and shovels doing the mining work. We'll also have an extraction plant there, which will separate the oil from the sands, waters, and clays. And from there, we will pump the bitumen out on a third-party pipeline to markets. So our operation will look fairly analogous to what you'll see at Syncrude's Aurora mine or Shell's Muskeg River mine.
When did you first hear about integrated landscape management?
It was a few years ago now. A number of things came together all around the same time. I was a member of the board of the Alberta Chamber of Resources, and they were starting to do some work educating people on ILM. There was some talk about the work that ALPAC had done with Gulf up at the Surmont project. And then the Pembina Institute came out with a report on fragmented forests and the need for the concern with respect to all the activity happening in Alberta's boreal forest. And around that same time, in the one fall evening, wound up having a dinner with Bill Hunter at the Hotel McDonald, and had a very productive conversation on a wide range of fronts. And for me, that evening really crystallized what integrated landscape management was and what it could mean for our company as well.
When you first started looking at these issues, what are some of the things that really stood out for you in terms of what could happen if the companies didn't get together and start working together on the land base?
Sure. I mean, there are a great deal of oil sands companies operating in northeastern Alberta, even more oil and gas companies exploring in throughout the boreal forest, building roads, shooting, going for seismic shooting shots, cutting down trees there. The cumulative impact from all the activity of road building and site clearing really would continue to eat away slowly at the extent of our boreal forest. You can actually see it now when you're flying up from either Calgary or Edmonton to the Fort McMurray region. You can see where there was once a big patch of green and trees. You see lines cutting all sorts of different directions. And if it was just clear that if industry didn't get together and start to cooperate and coordinate our efforts, that we would slowly, bit by bit, little by little, eat away at a great natural resource being our boreal forest. And that's not something any of us would have planned or intended. So it just makes sense for us to sit together and figure out how we can avoid it.
The area that your company is working in is also within the FMA for Alberta Pacific. How are you working together?
Coming out of the dinner Bill Hunter and I had, we said, let's get together, let's get our teams together and coordinate our plans. And it really just started off with sharing information. We let them know that on our leases we planned on clearing certain areas and mining certain areas. And then from there, we had with them share with us their plans for harvesting trees in the region as well. From there, we realized that there was an opportunity to coordinate efforts. ALPAC seconded a member of their staff to our project planning team, our mine planning team, and reclamation team. And really, we formed a relationship quickly. We started working together, and we didn't let the paper get ahead of the work. We didn't sit down and strike a formal MOU or a legal agreement. We just started to talk, share information, coordinate, and we were able to save thousands of hectares of land in the region by having them harvest this winter over the areas we plan on clearing next winter. So we don't have double the impact in the region, and we've coordinated our next 5 years' activities, and we hope to build on that. So it's thus far it's been easy.
What do you think of all the science that's behind the movement with integrated landscape management? How do you incorporate that?
Well, you can never have enough science, I guess. I mean, fundamentally, we're believers that the more information you have and the more you share it, the better you can perform and the better others can perform. So I know there is continued work going on at University of Alberta that industry is helping to fund and ALPAC is helping to fund as well on integrated landscape management. We are doing some work with the University of Alberta to have announced $1 million research grant for University of Alberta to study wetlands in northeastern Alberta. I think the more research we do and the better we understand ecosystems and their biodiversity, the better we are able to make go-forward plans that minimize impacts, and the better we'll be able to understand reclamation and putting the earth back in a natural form.
You're really heading off in new directions with integrating the integrated landscape management into your operations. That makes you something of a trailblazer. What message do you have for other people who are in the same position that you are within your industry and others?
I appreciate the comment, but don't really view myself as a trailblazer or True North as a trailblazer. If anyone has been the real champion for this cause, it's been the Alberta Chamber of Resources, and especially under the leadership of Bill Hunter when he was the chairman. Bill Hunter, of course, of ALPAC. He probably philosophically has been the big champion and the big trailblazer. I think what we represent is really the most recent and the biggest example of how ILM can be implemented and the benefits from it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was David Park, the president and CEO of True North Energy. What do you do as head of a forest company when your main competition for the trees is the energy sector? With all the new oil sands activity in northeastern Alberta, the energy sector is cutting almost as much forest as the logging companies. For Bill Hunter, the president and chief operating officer of Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, there was only one way to change this scenario. That was to get the energy and forestry sectors working together. Otherwise, there would be no way to manage the boreal forest for environmental and economic sustainability. Working with a team of biologists and foresters, Bill Hunter set out to spread the word about a new way of doing business, integrated landscape management.
Ecosystem management was a sound principle. We base the way we do things on science and research so that there's technical validation to this is a good thing, and we're very committed to that. But as we made observations around our forest management area, we found that we're not the only player on the land base. And in fact, energy was a very significant co-user of the FMA that we've been awarded as a company. In the early years, we happened to stumble across a research project being funded by DMI over in the Peace River area, working with Dr. Brad Stalfox. And what they were interested was the same thing we were. There's intervention and conflict on the land base from the energy sector. They really wanted to assess what that was doing in totality of their FMA. So they achieved a certain understanding and worked with Dr. Stalfox and came to a conclusion and then terminated their opportunity for that specific project. Through our environmental science team here at Alberta Pacific, we picked up on that this project had been in the works, and we were very interested in sort of the methodology and the philosophical approach to how do we assess the impacts on the land base. So we quickly grabbed Dr. Stalfox and asked him to come over and look at our huge FMA as his next project opportunity. And through the ELSI's model, which you've talked about previously on your show, there was a very onerous overburden of exercising and activities by different development opportunities in the FMA. So we took that, massaged it, and went to the energy sector and some of the other solid wood sector industries and said, you know, give us some numbers that you think are relevant to your activities on the land base. And hence, sort of enhance the opportunity of ELSI's. And then when the results all came in, we said, oh, we have to do something here.
Once you had a look at these figures, it sounds like it must have been pretty overwhelming. How did you deal with that then?
Well, we tried to rationalize what was fictional, what was factional, and when we were pretty confident in the information being presented by the models, and we tried many different variations and different data banks, we decided that that we need to approach the energy companies, and the best way to do that is face-to-face with industry, not to go through a government set of protocols to raise this issue, but just to go down in a non-controversial approach to some of the boardrooms in Calgary and say, look, we've just stumbled across some data and we'd like your opinion on what it means to you. And taking that tactic was very fruitful because a lot of people down there were very surprised and shocked by the same data that we were looking at and agreed that something should be done.
What was the most shocking thing to you?
When we put in the numbers that said there's going to be a significant increase in development by oil and gas players and some of the oil sands players, the drop-off in available annual allowable cut for our company dropped off significantly in a much shorter time than we ever envisioned. And you have to realize we're working on a 200-year planning horizon, so we look out that far, and it was just overwhelming.
I don't think it was a piece of cake, though, bringing people over to see things from your perspective. What are some of the things that you've had to do in order to bring out this idea about integrated landscape management and to really bring along other industries?
You're right, it wasn't a piece of cake, and it takes a lot of hard work and a lot of discipline. So when we presented these cases, we knew that to enhance the opportunity for the energy players by individual companies to get engaged and look for ways of minimizing the footprint that we leave through our developments, we had to find a business case. We had to find the dollars and cents reasons why you can do this. The obvious thing is the benefit is the ecosystem itself. So we were approached by Gulf, who is now Conoco. They were looking for some data and some mappings in the Surmont area. And as we talked to them and we knew that we wanted to start entertaining these joint ventures with different energy companies to look at how we could minimize the footprint, we were able to, through the efforts of Sean Wazel and his team, negotiate with Gulf Surmont that we could overlay our planning horizons, have a quick look at it just from an ecosystem management point of view, knowing full well that there was infrastructure redundancy from the two companies. At the end of that little exercise, we saw a 50% reduction in road requirements by the two companies in the same area and over $2 million savings in totality.
Well, $2 million in savings, that's nothing to sneeze at. Is that the sort of thing that you can see in other instances?
Oh, absolutely. But there has to be a carrot. So it takes strong leadership and it takes those little models of perfection that people can believe in and have confidence in. And once you show that there is an environmental reason for doing it and there's a business case for doing it, actually people, the lights go on quite quickly across the boreal forest. With the Gulf Surmont project as our model, and my term as the president of the Alberta Chamber of Resources, and having already done our homework in the boardrooms in Calgary, through the Chamber of Resources, we established a Blue Ribbon Steering Committee on the potential of integrated landscape management, and that was the birth of the program actually through the Chamber.
David Park, who is the head of True North Energy, talks about a get-together that you and he had where you really laid it on the line about integrated landscape management over a bottle of wine, I believe.
I think it was a Cabernet, if I can remember. But actually, in truth, we did have the Gulf Surmont project as our leading model, but we knew with the forecasted development of oil sands in the boreal that we needed a few more model companies to come in with LPAC and really look at the opportunities around ILM. True North, which is their parent company, is Koch, and I met Dave Park as a fellow board member with the Chamber of Resources. His progressive sort of slant to how he wanted to do his development for their particular oil science mine said maybe this is another candidate for another really good ILM model. So I set it up that I could buy Mr. Park a dinner at the Hotel McDonald and in exchange for his time just to listen to the story and see if there was something in his development plans that could incorporate integrated landscape management. One of the key discussions at the dinner, besides the quality of the wine, was the opportunity to enhance his EIA process for his development using the concept of best practices in ILM. And he was very, very in tune and quite supportive and actually quite excited about getting involved.
Where have you taken this now?
Well, it's now gone out of the boreal northeast into the boreal northwest and also down on the eastern slopes. More and more people through the chamber are getting excited about the business case and the opportunities just to plan together and see if we can minimize the imprint. As far as my own company, we started out with two models of joint venture opportunities, and we're now up to 11. So, and that's just over the course of the year. To do that, we had to take one of our senior planners in our woodlands group and second him to what we call the Integrated Landscape Management Team, ALPAC. And it's his responsibility through requests for dispositions on the land base to work with these different companies and show them that there are more and more opportunities. And it's a raging fire of enthusiasm right now.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again.
That was Bill Hunter, President and Chief Operating Officer of Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. One of the hottest topics of debate across the country is health care. With new technologies, new treatments, and new drugs, costs have skyrocketed. And the concern is how society will come up with innovative ways to pay for these things without dismantling the healthcare system. Dr. James Smythe is an economist with the University of Alberta. With the support of the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, he's embarking on a new project to study the issue of equity in healthcare financing in Alberta.
As opposed to, say, efficiency, which looks at, you know, how different funding mechanisms for healthcare will impact on people's incentives to use the healthcare system, or it will impact physicians' incentives or hospital incentives. I'm looking at equity, so how fair is the financial burden on families for financing healthcare?
How are you going to go about looking for answers here?
Well, it's best to describe it with an example. So what I'm looking at is what share of a household's income is spent on healthcare, ultimately. And how does that share vary across the income range? So do households that earn $20,000, do they spend a greater percentage of their income on healthcare than, say, a household that earns $50,000?
How have you designed your research?
Well, I'm going to be collecting data from a variety of sources and trying to piece it together. It's really like piecing together a puzzle, sort of a fact-finding mission. So I'll be taking information from different surveys. The Survey of Household Spending is one, which is a StatsCan survey that asks people basically what they spend all of their money on. So that'll pick up things like private payments for private insurance or over-the-counter drugs or prescription drug payments or dental payments. Then there's surveys such as just the general social survey. There's also workforce-related surveys that ask questions about employer-provided health care insurance, which is actually an important piece to try to pick up. It's a very hard one to pick up because it can represent a fairly large portion of private payments. So, for example, if my employer gives me a benefit for working here, and the benefit is supplemental insurance that covers my dental care, covers my prescription drug purchases, well, essentially that's money that's ultimately coming out of my pocket in lieu of higher wages. So I have to try to track that too. It's kind of hard to track that. So I have to piece together private spending out of pocket for direct healthcare purchases with employer-provided healthcare insurance. And then I have to look from that data at the household's income situation and try to assess what their tax burden is, and then try to attribute from all the taxes they pay how much of that ends up in the healthcare system. So it's a big puzzle.
What got you interested in this question?
With the changes that are being talked about in Mazankowski and in other provinces about changes to the financing of the healthcare system, it seemed like an appropriate time to look at the question, and specifically because then we can do these scenario analyses. Well, once we know where we are today, then we have a base work where we can do comparisons. What will happen if we do change the financing of the healthcare system? What impact is that going to have on households across the income spectrum?
You say this hasn't been done in Canada before, but certainly the European countries have looked at that. What are some of the base figures that you're looking at over there that you can use to make some sort of comparisons? What have they said about the percentage of household income that's going towards health care costs?
Some of the basic conclusions that have come out of the European studies or the American studies are that reliance on the public tax system to finance healthcare generally is a progressive element because the tax system itself is generally progressive in most countries. It's interesting to note because some countries use purpose-built taxes to finance healthcare. For example, in Europe, it's common in a few countries to finance healthcare largely, if not entirely, through payroll taxes, so just taxing workers, which is actually a relatively regressive form of taxation. So if that's the way you raise your tax money, then it's not as progressive as just using the general tax system as we do here in Canada. We just use the general tax system. All taxes get distributed to all types of government departments. For example, the healthcare premiums are a good example. They look and they sound like a dedicated tax, and they're terribly regressive. There's no doubt about it. It's a lump sum payment paid by everybody that's not dependent on income, or relatively not dependent on income. But ultimately, those the money that you pay for the Alberta healthcare premiums actually just goes into the general pool of government revenue. It doesn't go to the Department of Health specifically. So although it looks like a specific tax, it's not really. We're more of a general tax system. Anyways, some of the other implications are that the more a country relies on private financing, out-of-pocket payments, private insurance, the more regressive the overall healthcare finance picture becomes. In particular, the United States comes out as clearly the most regressive of all nations. And that's, you know, largely because they, of all industrial nations, rely the most on private sources of healthcare finance.
How much money does go around in this system of healthcare, whether it's Medicare or what we're paying out for drugs and various different things out of our pockets? How much money are we talking about in this system?
Well, in Canada, it's roughly about 10% of GDP, between 9 and 10%, and it's been there for about the past 10 years or so. So right now, that would be about probably about $110 billion a year. So it's clearly one of the largest industries in the country. There's no doubt about it. Of that $100 billion or so, 70% is through the public system, financed through taxation, and 30% comes straight from our pockets, paid to private companies, private insurance companies, private providers. So it's a lot of cash. There's no doubt about that. One of the interesting questions, or I guess interesting elements of where that money goes, is one of the largest cost drivers has been prescription drugs. Well, over-the-counter drugs too, but I think largely prescription drugs. Their cost increase, annual cost increase, is much higher than just about any, in fact, I'm sure, all other components of healthcare spending over the past, well, for quite a while now, 10 years or so. And since in Canada, most prescription drugs are financed privately, right? They're not covered by the public healthcare system. It is a bit of a concern that a greater reliance on drugs will inevitably drag our system towards more private finance, unless things are changed. Well, there's lots of things you could do to change that. You could maybe regulate drug prices more stringently, or maybe start looking at incorporating and covering some of these prescription drugs by the public programs. Otherwise, yeah, there's definitely been a slow but steady push towards more private sources of finance over the past 10 years anyways.
Thank you very much, James.
Okay, thank you.
That was Dr. James Smythe. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Economics at the University of Alberta. And he is a population health investigator sponsored by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Tune in to our new website at innovationalberta.com. The program is sponsored by the Alberta Conservation Association, Health Sciences Association of Alberta, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, University of Lethbridge, and the Alberta Research Council. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and produced by Porcupine Stone Productions. I'm Cheryl Croucher.